Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendowed.org. The California Healthcare Foundation, working to build a more effective, compassionate, and just healthcare system. On the web at chcf.org/health-equity.
From KVPR, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Today on our show, we take you out of California to the Central American country of Belize. It's where writer Diana Markham's second travel memoir is based. And later, a look back at the local stories and events that shaped our year. But first, every December, Catholic Latinos across the state honor the Virgin de Guadalupe. The celebration of Las Posadas commemorates the appearance of Mary, the mother of Jesus, to an indigenous man named Juan Diego in Mexico in 1531. Honoring that tradition was especially important this year for a farm worker community that's been hit hard during the pandemic. KVPR's Mati Bolaños brings us this story from Firebaugh, population 8,300 in Fresno County.
A float decorated with photos of the Virgen de Guadalupe winds from the church through neighborhoods of tiny pastel houses and passes the local park, followed by a procession of about 200 people.
¡Que viva la Virgen! ¡Que viva la Virgen!
That's 64-year-old Evelia García leading the chant at the head of the procession. She's a petite woman who at first seems shy and soft-spoken. She's wearing a red dress with an embroidered image of the Virgen de Guadalupe on the front. 20 women and their daughters have on the same outfit. They're a part of the dance group from St. Joseph's Catholic Church here in Firebaugh. Because of the pandemic, they weren't able to perform in 2020. The beloved celebration was canceled last year. COVID hit farmworking towns like Firebaugh especially hard. Farm workers couldn't afford to stay home, and the Central Valley continues to have some of the highest case rates in the state. Father Rayana Budota says after a year of immense loss, his parishioners were really excited about reviving the celebration of Las Posadas.
People, you know, they have faith and they are longing because for some time they missed this Eucharist in-person coming and participation.
That's especially true for Evelia. She's originally from Tequila, Jalisco in Mexico. She says she grew up reciting the rosary every night with her siblings. Years later, she moved to a remote part of Fresno County with her husband. He worked in the fields, and she worked at the local tomato processing facility. She says it was important for her to continue practicing her faith.
Pero vivíamos también en un rancho y no podía participar aquí en los eventos que había en la iglesia aquí.
They lived in a rural area, she says, so they couldn't participate in church events. Over time, Garcia and her husband saved up enough money to buy a car. That's when, Garcia says, she started attending group prayers at St. Joseph's. She loved it and started going to church 7 days a week for nearly 40 years. Then, in December 2019, her husband died of colon cancer. 3 months later, COVID hit. Garcia says the beginning of the pandemic was the loneliest time of her life.
Me enfermé de estar ahí encerrada.
She got sick of being indoors, and with the churches closed, she says, it felt like she was dying, and her soul was dying too.
Yo me estaba muriendo, mi alma se estaba muriendo.
That changed when a friend from church brought communion bread to her doorstep.
Se me quitó la depresión, se me quitó todo lo que tenía.
She says the depressive feeling left her. Everything she was feeling disappeared, and from then on, she felt happier. She began praying again and helping the church in any way she could. She also joined the choir and started teaching Aztec dances for the Virgen de Guadalupe celebration.
Unas me enseñó mi papá y otras yo miro en la internet. Entre yo y mi hermana buscamos los pasos y cómo.
She learned some dances as a kid from her dad, she says, and the others she found online. She and her sisters would practice together and teach other dancers.
No se pierdan, son nuestras raíces.
Garcia's sister Marta says dancing is in their blood.
También participaba, era entrenador de danza y tengo un hermano en los baños que también ellos participan en las danzas.
Her dad taught dance, she says. Her brothers dance, she and her sister dance. They came to do their part. It's not just the Garcia sisters. This tradition has brought a lot of families from Fireball together. Farm worker Maria Dolores Ramirez Martinez dances with her two daughters, who are 15 and 4. They've got feathers on their headdresses, and they wear ayoyotes, or anklets festooned with hard shells, that shake and clink with every step.
Sí, muy emocionada de hacerlo, empezar otra vez este año, porque pues otros años no pudimos hacerlos, toda la gente encerradas por el miedo.
She says she felt grateful to be able to dance again because last year they couldn't do it. Everyone was stuck inside, afraid to let their kids out until now, when they can celebrate again. Her oldest daughter, Arcelia Fuerte, agrees.
It's like really like to bring joy to the people because of COVID and all the lives that were lost, and since we just want to bring happiness to them, to like, or with our dances.
Some residents of the small community set up chairs on their lawns to watch the procession. Others hold their phones up to capture the moment. This is the first time since the start of the pandemic they've been able to celebrate their faith together and feel hopeful for the future. For the California Report, I'm Madi Bolaños in Fireball.
That piece was edited by Rebecca Plevin and Sasha Koga. Audio mix by Seal Moeller of the California Report. This story is part of the Central Valley News Collaborative, which is supported by the Central Valley Community Foundation with technology and training support by Microsoft Corporation. This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. The small city of Sanger in Fresno County is known as the nation's Christmas tree city. But why? KVPR's Sarith Hawk visited Sanger to get the story behind the slogan.
It's just before Christmas, and there's not a lot of stirring going on in downtown Sanger. It's raining, and the streets are fairly quiet. The only obvious signs of the festive holiday are an artificial tree in the middle of the main intersection, and holiday banners hanging from the lampposts. So for some, it might initially come as a surprise that Sanger is known as the nation's Christmas tree city. It's on the city's emblem and in signage. I showed the slogan to Scott Hubbard, who's lived just outside of Sanger for the past 3 years.
You've seen this?
Yeah, up at 180.
You don't know what it means?
No, because I don't see any Christmas trees.
CEO and president of the Sanger District Chamber of Commerce, Karen Pearson, says there's a reason for that.
We're not the Christmas trees, plural, city. We're the nation's Christmas tree city, you know, singular.
That singular tree is the General Grant Giant Sequoia in Kings Canyon National Park, officially designated as the nation's Christmas tree. The story goes that in 1924, R.J. Sr. and Charles E. Lee, both of the Sanger Chamber of Commerce, were wandering in the Grant Grove area of the park when a little girl approached the General Grant tree. Pearson reads the story from there.
After a moment of complete silence, she said, mostly to herself, "What a lovely Christmas tree that would be." She then turned and ran off into the grove. They never learned her name, but they couldn't forget her words.
The following Christmas, Lee wrote to President Calvin Coolidge suggesting the General Grant be adopted as the nation's Christmas tree. It was made official in 1926, and an annual trek to the tree has been held ever since on the second Sunday in December. This was the 96th year. A video captured the festive event with bell ringers, carolers, and a flag and memorial wreath-laying ceremony. The tree is also the nation's only living shrine to fallen service members.
It's not just the little Sanger's Christmas tree. It's not Fresno County's Christmas tree. It's not California's Christmas tree. It's the entire nation's Christmas tree. Like, that's huge, you know?
Since the national designation in 1926, Sanger has received a presidential letter each year in honor of the commemoration.
This is one of my favorites, and this is the original, so I pulled it out for you.
She carefully takes a letter out of a plastic casing, signed by John F. Kennedy.
It says, you have my very best wishes for a joyous and successful Christmas service.
Other presidential letters in the pile include Ronald Reagan and Richard Nixon. This year's letter came via email from President Biden.
And it says, I send my warmest greetings to all those gathered at the Sanger District Chamber of Commerce's 94th. It's the 96th.
But despite the recognition, Pearson says getting the message out to the public is a bit of a challenge.
People think that we're supposed to have Christmas trees, like we grow Christmas trees. And so it's a message that we're constantly trying to get out there. Like,
this is a marketing problem for the Chamber of Commerce.
It is a marketing problem for the Chamber of Commerce.
Sanger native Courtney Ramirez thinks there's an easy solution. She fired off a recent tweet about it.
I am here again for my yearly rant. Why doesn't Sanger, California lean into the Christmas Tree City thing all year long? At the very least, do a pop-up ornament store in December. I know there's got to be an empty storefront on 7th Street.
Ramirez says she has a soft spot for small businesses and all things local. She says she wants to see her hometown take advantage of its claim to fame.
I think it's just a natural branding that might be a little easy to lean into.
Pearson says there are already major holiday events in December that draw crowds. There's the Toyland Parade and a tree lighting ceremony in the center of town that harkens back to the nation's official Christmas tree. It's a sapling of the General Grant, gifted back in 1939. For KVPR News, I'm Sarith Hoff.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Now we're going to leave the San Joaquin Valley and head to Belize, where Fresno-based writer Diana Markham's second travel memoir is set. The book, Fallen Stones, will be out early next year. KVPR's Alice Daniel visited Markham in Belize in 2020 to get a window into her experience, right before COVID-19 shut everything down.
Before we get to Belize, let me tell you a story about how Diana and I met 16 years ago, back when she was a reporter for the Fresno Bee. It starts with my son Atticus, who was 4 at the time. One day, he and his babysitter were at a thrift store called La Tienda in our neighborhood. He had parked his Red Flyer tricycle at the entrance, and while he was looking at books in the back, a volunteer sold the trike. Later that day, I left a note on La Tienda's front door describing the incident in hopes of finding clues to the sale. Diana saw the note and interviewed us for a feature story. As a reporter myself, I noticed she didn't take many notes, and she did a lot of observing. It was a little unsettling. Days later, the story was published, a beautiful vignette of the Tower District community and the inadvertent sale of a beloved trike, which, thanks to her story, we got back. I mention this because I've always been impressed by the way Diana reports and writes. Now an LA Times reporter, she won a Pulitzer Prize in feature writing in 2015 for her coverage of the drought. And her first travel memoir was about the Azores and its relationship to the San Joaquin Valley. So when she was in Belize reporting on her new book, I decided to witness her experience there, to report on the reporter, so that I could share her story with you. So here we go. We start our story about a month into Diana's stay. We're en route to a house that's on a butterfly farm in the middle of a rainforest.
Okay, here's where we come up to our turn off to Fallen Stones.
Diana's partner, Mark Cross, or simply Cross as she refers to him, is driving the Jeep on a steep dirt road that was built by hand.
This is where I stop and put it into four-wheel drive, so hang on to your hats.
Until Diana and Cross moved into the house on stilts, she says no one had lived in it for years. No one except...
a lot of creatures that had made it home.
Such as?
Well, all the ones that I guess are still making it home, but there were more of them.
So what was your first impression?
She says, aside from scorpions, there were also a number of bats hanging on the walls. Now I'm beginning to wonder.
I'm going to be sleeping with bats?
No, they're not in the house. They're on the porch.
Okay.
Yeah, but they're on the part of the port.
The house was built 30 years ago and belongs to an Englishman, Clive Farrell, who plays an instrumental role in Diana's book. Clive loves nature, particularly butterflies. He and his business partner lived in the house while they started Fallen Stones.
Now we're getting up to the steep part.
Diana and Cross first traveled this road in 2018 while on vacation. They were staying at an eco lodge, and one of the guest activities was a trip to Clive's butterfly farm. It didn't start out well. Diana was in the back seat of a truck, kind of like I am now, and she was thinking she was not the explorer type.
This is not for me, right?
But then...
Then we got up and we got to the top, and, you know, I came out of the car, and it's just like...
I have to say, I had the same reaction. The vista is amazing. Solid rainforest for miles, no roads. Guatemala somewhere in the distance.
Pretty amazing, huh?
And from here, we walk down a flight of stone stairs, winding through the jungle. Diana's counted 159 steps. The stones, she's been told, are from a nearby Maya ruin.
They got them from Lubatun. This is ancient Maya ruins that we walked down to go to the house.
It's not surprising. There are Maya ruins all over Belize. Even the church in the nearby village of San Pedro, Colombia, is built from stones found at Lubatun.
Just always kind of look where you step. There was a giant tarantula the other night.
159 steps later, we're at the house and walking up the stairs to the covered porch.
Here's where the bats live. But I mean, they sleep in the day and they leave at night. So, whoa! Ah!
Yeah. Why'd you say whoa?
It went over your head, sorry.
And there's always one.
So what led Diana to share a house on stilts with bats and scorpions? The answer is just a quick trek down a dirt path that winds like a ribbon to the butterflies. Listen to this. Wait, let me amplify it. Sounds a bit like rain, doesn't it? Or maybe fire? My mic is right next to the flapping of blue morpho butterfly wings inside a flight cage.
And see how they flash? There have even been reports, like from bush pilots that were flying over the jungle canopy, that they could see the flash of them.
The flash of their wings, it's kind of like a daytime disco inside this cage. The blue is so metallic. On the edges of the wings are rows of black dots. Two rows means it's a female, one a male. Many of the offspring here will be sent as pupae to Clive's butterfly exhibit in England. It's also where they repackage some of them and send them to zoos and museums all over the world. But these connections around the globe begin in this cage.
We start with eggs.
That's Marcellinus Scholl, another character in Diana's book. Every day, he and about a dozen other employees walk or push their bikes up that steep road we were on to get here from San Pedro, Colombia.
You can see the butterfly, a female butterfly laying the eggs, you see over there.
He points out a leaf where a butterfly has just pushed out an egg. Beyond it are many more. They look like gelatinous raindrops, perfect tiny translucent globes on a sea of bright green. Every evening, Marcellinus collects the eggs in handmade wooden boxes and carries them into a small wooden hut on stilts about 20 feet away. There they hatch into caterpillars and 9 weeks later become pupae. The pupae that don't get mailed to England are returned to the flight cage where they emerge as butterflies. They hang from sticks in tidy, neat rows.
Every day we have them hatching.
The ones that hatch in here will breed and feed on old fruit piled high.
They go to rotten fruits like pineapple, bananas, like mangoes. They like to go to the juices.
Smelly juices that belie their winged beauty. But it's not just this global enterprise in the middle of a rainforest that caught Diana's interest. It's the fact that it has survived so long. In 2001, the farm was hit by Hurricane Iris. Shortly thereafter, wildfires destroyed what the hurricane had missed. It took years, but the farm was rebuilt. These natural disasters are something Diana understands.
I don't want to be somebody that plays the same card over and over and over again, but I am from California, and I did live through the drought, and I did see, as a journalist, incredible fires over and over and over.
But it's also just the beauty of this little butterfly farm that protects wildlife and gives conservation jobs to Maya villagers who take such care and precision, shepherding butterflies from eggs to caterpillars to pupae.
She's the radio reporter I told you about,
yeah.
Which is why she has the weird thing on her head.
Yeah.
What is your name?
Anselmo.
Like Anselmo Ekel, who feeds the caterpillars that have hatched from the blue morpho eggs. Right now, he's dumping a lot of poop out of the boxes.
Well, in this stage, the big ones, it's almost like a pond. Yeah, overnight.
Some are almost to the pupae stage, which takes about 2 months.
As you can see here, this one already made a silk. And in 2 to 3 days' time, it will become a pupa.
On my last day at Fallen Stones, I asked Diana about how she's reporting and organizing her book. She says her writing strategy now comes straight out of Birds of Belize by Lee Jones. The first chapter says, when you're looking at a bird, don't write anything down.
The minute that you look down at a paper or start writing down what you're seeing, you're losing time of looking at that bird. You know, you just have this one precious fleeting moment to observe, and then you can go back and write it down and research it later. And I was like, oh, obviously.
For KVPR, I'm Alice Daniel in Belize.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. As the year comes to a close, I checked in with some local reporters to get their thoughts about the local stories and events that shaped 2021. Joining the conversation from the Fresno Bee were opinion editor Tad Weber and Latino Communities reporter Nadia Lopez. Also with us was Lois Henry, CEO of SJV Water.
You know, you all cover different issues, different parts of the valley. So I'm really looking forward to hearing all of your different perspectives on what happened in 2021. So, Lois, let's start with you. Looking back on the last year, what do you think was, you know, one of the most impactful local stories?
I'm going to go with drought. I'm going to say that. But not just because I cover water, but also because I think that this was a really difficult year in California. And of course, it came at a time when people were trying to implement a new groundwater management act. So it was just sort of strife on top of strife. And it was an unprecedented situation where, you know, we've had a lot of dry years and we've had multiple dry years, you know, 2012 to 2016 comes to mind, with 2015 being the worst. But this was, I think the really big sort of head smack was that people didn't realize, and by people, I mean like the Department of Water Resources and State Water Resources Control Board and the Bureau of Reclamation. Mother Nature really pulled a double whammy on them, where we had a really, really exceptionally dry fall last fall, not this most recent one, but the fall before. And of course, everybody remembers the wildfires, et cetera. And then there wasn't any snow at the higher elevations like they always count on. And come springtime, everybody was sort of like, the rug got pulled out from everybody's feet. And so all the planning that everybody had done just sort of went out the window, and, you know, people were scrambling, and, you know, domestic wells were going dry. And I mean, it was a dry year, and that's difficult, but then it was sort of like, it just sort of, Mother Nature just sort of pulled a little bit of a switcheroo on everyone. So I'm going to say that drought was a really impactful story.
Without a doubt. So Tad, from your perspective, what do you think was the big story that shaped 2021?
Thanks, Kathleen. And Lois makes a very compelling argument about the drought. For sure, that's a huge deal. I think, though, that I'm going to say the biggest story this year has just been COVID. And we're probably all very tired of having that be the big story. But let me give your listeners a little data to back up my point there. So as of last Friday in Fresno County, 2,200 people had died from COVID. Valley-wide, here in the San Joaquin region, 4,800 people, almost 5,000 people have died from COVID. And the Valley continues to significantly lag the state for vaccinations. So Fresno County, for example, has 54% of its population fully vaccinated, but 40% are not. That 40% represents 400,000 people. And Fresno County has the best vaccination rate in the San Joaquin Valley. Kings County is the worst at only 39.5% vaccinated. The state rate is almost 65% of state residents have been vaccinated. No Valley County is within 10 points of that state rate. And if we were still back in that, in those color tiers that we used to have back when the pandemic was getting going, all the Valley counties would be in the purple status, meaning widespread transmission. And now, of course, as we've all been hearing in the news, there's a new variant, Omicron, which is highly contagious. So, you know, just the facts, just the biology of the virus is significant. But then when you put on top of that the political and cultural factors that we've been wrestling with this last year, the Valley is a more conservative area than the coast, and there's been a lot of conservative pushback on vaccination mandates, masking mandates, a lot of opposition to those things. And as an opinion editor, I would argue there's been some poor leadership by our elected officials. Certainly, they haven't always supported what public health officials, and in terms of our counties, the very people that are working for the county boards of supervisors trying to solve this problem, the elected supervisors have not supported them because they have been lukewarm at best, often on the mandates. And Nadia could probably speak to this better than I, but I think there's also been some cultural forces at play with distrust and hesitancy among some of our ethnic groups. Black people, for example, have very legitimate fears and distrust of public health mandates, given the history of experimentation that some of them had to go through, unfortunately. And there's a lot of misinformation on things like TikTok that have led some Latino folks to not want to get vaccinated. By that, I mean, you know, these rumors that if you get the vaccine, you're going to become sterile. That's not true, obviously, but that's what goes around as misinformation. And then lastly, the health professionals themselves were very resistant to getting vaccines at the start, and that sent a really mixed message. So put all this together, COVID, big story.
Well, yeah, again, I couldn't agree more. For yet another year, we have been so shaped by this pandemic. So Nadia, as Tad implied, you know, you cover Latino communities for the Fresno Bee. I'm fascinated to know, what do you believe was the biggest story of this past year?
Yeah, I would have to agree, you know, with Tad, because particularly how COVID has specifically affected certain underserved and Latino communities in the Valley. I've done a lot of reporting this year on how small outbreaks in schools can have long-lasting effects on certain communities, can really affect their ability to recover from the virus, even as other more affluent communities, even within Fresno in urban areas or in coastal cities, feel like they may be coming out of this. So COVID has definitely been one of those bigger events that has had just a cascading number of issues that has affected and exacerbated equity concerns.
Well, you know, we've been talking about these stories that have just really penetrated the news cycle over the past year. But, you know, obviously there have been things that have happened that have maybe not gotten as much attention as, say, drought or the pandemic. And so I'm curious to hear what your thoughts are about the most maybe underappreciated story of the past year? What's something that should have gotten more attention? And we'll just go in the same order. Lois, you're the CEO of SJV Water. What do you think went under the radar?
Oh, that's a really hard question. There's so many things. You know, for water, I mean, if that's, you know, kind of what I'm going to stick with water, I think that one of the underappreciated things that is happening is that small farmers are really getting squeezed, and that big corporations are buying up farmland probably for the water rights, and that our small farming I don't want to make it sound like we're just, you know, filled here in the valley with pastoral small 160-acre farms. I mean, everybody knows that we're not. We've been home to a lot of, especially in Kern County, a lot of large, very large, quote, family farms or even corporation farms for many, many decades. But with the advent of SGMA, the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, it has become even more imperative to have a lot of land in order to farm a little land. Because you're not going to be able to pump groundwater as freely as you were previously. So you're seeing a lot of groundwater movement and a lot of surface water movement for trades, for profits, for straight up sales that small farmers they just don't have the resources to get in on. And that impacts their ability to pull up water from their own land. And then you're starting to see the implementation of some SGMA rules where one very large farmer that I've talked to, John Bidovich, he has more than 100,000 acres in the valley. His strategy is to farm 30% and use 70% of his land just for the groundwater. And that's just great if you have 100,000 acres.
Wow.
But if you have 100 acres, you need to farm all that ground to make a living. And so I was talking to a lot of these small farmers in Kings County, and I know there's a small farmers association that's gotten together. They're trying to lobby the legislature, and that just really has gone under the radar. There's a lot in the media where this sort of like farmers are lumped into one giant pot, and everybody thinks they're Stuart Resnick, owner of Wonderful, or, you know, the Boswell Company. I mean, very large, very incredibly wealthy organizations. But there's a lot out there still in this valley that are very small farmers. And by that, I mean 1,000 acres. And that sounds like a lot to me and you, because you and I don't own or never will own 1,000 acres.
But right.
For farming in the Central Valley, especially with groundwater rules, that is a small farm. So it's just going to be, I think that hasn't been covered. I touched on it a little bit. I think that I need to do a lot more. What is our valley going to look like in the next, you know, 10 years as things start rolling forward? Climate change is changing the way that our water is allocated. And this is the backbone of our valley. So I do think that's been undercovered and something I definitely will spend a lot more time on in the next year.
Nadia, do you want to tell us what your underrated story of the year was?
Yeah. I 100% agree. I think there were a lot of stories in the news about how the drought affects farmers, but not all of them represented the stories of small minority farmers, especially Hmong farmers who, you know, cultivate crops that are unique to their cultures and to where they came from. Small minority farmers like Latinos as well. And I just think that their stories are so unique because many of these issues that they face, you know, these precarious situations that they're in are exacerbated due to the limited funding that they may have, the language barriers and renting rather than owning the land. And I just think that some of those stories really didn't make it, didn't really circulate within the news cycle like other larger stories about, you know, the struggles of farmers amid the drought. I also think that, you know, when it comes to the viability of these small farms, talking about issues like SGMA and how that will in its rollout as it becomes implemented, how that will continue to affect them in the future. If a farmer is renting the land, for example, it may be more profitable in the future for the person who owns the land to sell that available water supply or to sell their land for real estate purposes or something along those lines. But then what happens to these small farmers that are trying to make a living? On top of that, many of them don't know that they have access to certain loans or resources or these other programs. And that could also really just affect what kinds of crops that are produced in the valley, what kinds of foods that we will eat,
or we have access to, and also, like, you know, just how that will change our food landscape for the future. So I would 100% agree that that was one of those stories that, you know, didn't make it to the top of people's radar.
All right, Tad, let's throw it over to you. What went under the radar last year?
Kathleen, I think you're going to see a theme here in all of our responses, and that really is the theme of ethnic communities, culturally diverse communities suffering economically from neglect in its various forms. So Nadia spoke to that when it comes to cultural farmers. Here at the Bee this year, we have tried to bring more attention to West Fresno. So West Fresno is exactly that. It's on the west side of town. Fresno, in case your listeners don't know, is a large city, over 500,000 people. The West Fresno neighborhood is 40,000 people. So that's in and of itself. That neighborhood is very sizable. And yet it's only got one supermarket. It only has a handful of other types of stores and shops, very few restaurants, high poverty, low education, poor health, and it is one of the most polluted urban areas in the state of California. So we've been advocating with several editorials this year that it's time for city leaders in Fresno, and really the county leadership as well, because it comes into West Fresno in the form of county islands. It's time for them to really get serious about trying to lift up this part of town. Because Mayor Jerry Dyer campaigned on a theme of One Fresno. But as long as this sizable neighborhood is going to not have a proper economy, it doesn't have enough parks, has high crime, as long as that continues, that's basically dragging the whole city down, even if you're a person in North Fresno and you never go there, which many people in North Fresno have never been to West Fresno. Mayor Dyer told me this week that he spends right now 70% of his time on issues dealing with West Fresno. So it's obviously very significant to him because it's got a lot of problems. And I would be remiss if I didn't end this little segment by pointing out there is a bright spot, and that is actually the construction right now of a satellite campus for Fresno City College in West Fresno. That will be a tremendous thing for that community. It's really going to be a neat school. It's going to have some specialized technical education programs that kids in West Fresno can benefit from. And that is a perfect example of how government can really help lift up a underprivileged area.
We just have a couple minutes before we wrap up, and I'd like to give you all an opportunity to just go around one more time and share what you might be looking toward in 2022. And you know, man, if we could end with some kind of optimism, that sure would be great. But Lois, I'll go ahead and start with you.
Well, covering water, optimism. Let me think. In 2022, I'll definitely be doing some stories about, in fact, we're working on a larger sort of database project about groundwater recharge and how much more groundwater recharge there is and ways people are looking to better store and store water and prepare for dry years. And sort of the, you know, what's happening, we're definitely going to be keeping up on what's happening with the canals that have sunk because of subsidence. So we'll be looking at what's going on with that. There seems to be fixes moving forward for the Bryant Kern Canal, at least, which is a major conveyor of water in the valley. And we will be looking at the corporate ownership of water rights in the valley and what that means. And another thing I'm going to be looking at is what may or may not be, I'm not even sure yet, but sort of a greater assertion of tribal rights to water, which could be really interesting.
Oh, absolutely. Nadia, what's on your radar?
Well, yes, as a part of the Central Valley News Collaborative, you know, a lot of our focus this year has been on reporting on COVID and its effects on the Latino community. So I think, you know, as this pandemic becomes more endemic, we'll be exploring what that means for the Latino communities in the Central Valley. This is just a theme that we'll be continuing to investigate, you know, whether we're in a recovery or a hunker down mode. Latinos have been harder hit, and recovery is going to look different for them. It's going to look different for them within the Valley. It's going to look different for them across the state. When it comes to issues like vaccine access, infrastructure concerns, vaccine hesitancy, misinformation, none of those things have gone away. These are all going to continue to be factors that affect these communities' ability to recover from the pandemic. So I am really trying to focus on, you know, how equitable recovery will look like in terms of health, education, labor, and other issues that are specific to these communities.
And Tad, what do you have your eye on as we move into 2022?
Well, 2022 is a big election year. So that's going to take a significant amount of my time as an opinion editor. We will be doing editorial boards in the key races with candidates. We already have a probably unique situation for the nation with the retirement of Devin Nunes from the 22nd Congressional. And his term isn't up, and so there's going to be a set of elections just to fill out his term, which was to expire at the end of next year. Then there's going to be a whole other group of elections for the new seat that will make up the 22nd district. There'll be a whole other set of elections for that. Redistricting, as you know, has been going on and is just about completed. The state commission is on deadline here within the next week to turn in the final maps of what the every 10-year redistricting looks like. And then the candidates for Congress especially, as well as our local races, will know just what the boundaries are for the geographic districts. I think also there'll be city council races, and particularly interesting will be school boards. Especially in the COVID pandemic, a lot of hard words and social unrest has been appearing at school boards. People have been frustrated. Parents have been frustrated with schools being closed, then the masking mandates, et cetera. I went to a Fresno Unified School Board meeting, was pretty shocked to see how people were addressing the school board. It was kind of ridiculous, actually. But it's real. It's happening in our democracy. And underlying all of it, of course, is what is the health of our democracy? How well are these elections going to occur? I very much urge all voters, please participate in this coming year. It's a big deal.
Well, I want to thank all of you for the work that you do to report on our community and for taking time to reflect back on what has been a really, really volatile and eventful 2021. I've been talking with Nadia Lopez and Tad Weber from the Fresno Bee and Lois Henry from SJV Water. Thank you all so much for being with us, and happy holidays.
Happy holidays. Thank you.
Bye. Thank you so much.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. A new album by the Bay Area-based Baroque music ensemble Agave has been nominated for a Grammy Award for Best Classical Compendium. KVPR's David Ouse spoke with Agave founding member, guitarist, and Fresno City College instructor, Dr. Kevin Cooper.
My life is a pathway of sorrow. I've struggled and toiled in the sun with hope that the dawn of tomorrow would break.
That's countertenor Reginald Mobley with the ensemble Agave singing Resignation by Florence Price from their new album American Originals, A New World, A New Canon, which celebrates four centuries of extraordinary music by Black and Brown composers from North and South America. Kevin Cooper, first tell me about the group Agave. How long have you been part of it? How long has it been around? And what's your focus musically?
Well, we started back in Los Angeles in about 2007 or 8. And it were several musicians that were classmates of mine from the University of Southern California or were just living in town. And we decided we wanted to start up a Baroque band playing 17th century music. I just found it extremely intriguing because the music is so old that it's new again. I have this wonderful time every time I play it, feeling like I'm finding these treasures. I'm discovering this music that had a bright luster, but has been forgotten. And another reason that it's fun to play this old music is that there's an absolute expectation that you should bring yourself to it and improvise and decorate and ornament a lot. The more you do it, the better it is and the more authentic it is. So that is really exciting as well. Kind of reminds me a little bit of the music you play, jazz. I do have a similar taste for that creative spirit.
Let's talk about the collaborator, this wonderful countertenor vocalist.
Yeah, we have been really fortunate to work with Reginald Mobley for like 3 records now and perform with him often. We tour with him around the nation, and he's just such an incredible musician and has this beautiful instrument. You know, a countertenor is this a man singing with his head voice, you know, super high, but he has a real special quality where his is very robust and strong rather than a, you know, a light or flutier voice. I mean, that voice type is unique already, but then the way he sounds is extra special.
Let's talk about the album project itself and the kind of the unifying concept of the record and how you went about selecting material for it.
Well, the harpsichordist or keyboardist, he also plays organ, is named Henry Lebedinsky. And he and Reginald, or Reggie, we call him, were touring around with a voice and piano concert for a long time with some of the same music. And they were just reaching really enthusiastic audiences. And since they also play with us, they thought, why don't we kind of expand this to something that the group can play? And we can arrange some of these that exist in a piano voice format for an ensemble in voice format. And so we did. And this was back in the early part of 2020. So we actually debuted it in February at the Tucson Desert Song Festival. And we just immediately knew, like, oh, man, this works great. And we really hit on something special. So then the pandemic hits and the calendars of all the musicians are instantly wiped clean. So we have nothing to do because there is no employment for a concert artist. So that is coupled with the fact that the death of Breonna Taylor and George Floyd kind of ignite Black Lives Matter and this hyper awareness of the racial dissonance and inequity in our nation. So that made us think, not only do we have an opportunity here to record this record, but we kind of feel a moral obligation to record this record. So that gave us some urgency and we did it back in the summer of 2020.
It's an eclectic mix of composers across the Americas. The project achieves a great goal of shining light on these wonderful composers. Florence Price, lots of arts organizations have started programming her work in the last couple of years, so she's come into bigger light lately. And then beyond her, Scott Joplin is like the one kind of known composer on the list to a general audience, right?
Yeah, so we really enjoyed being able to play the extreme variety that's represented on the record. So you're right. It's from, you know, 2 continents, North and South America, and it spans 400 years. But it's also a variety of musical orchestrations.
The album begins with that piece, Resignation, by Florence Price. The next piece, I was astounded to learn that there was this amazing Baroque composer from Cuba, Esteban Salas y Castro.
So Esteban Salas, you know, has been enjoying kind of uninterrupted popularity in Cuba since making music back in the 18th century. But here we're totally unaware. Of course, there are some records of his music, but the larger consciousness is unaware. And the exciting thing is that not only is that kind of a neat story that there's this American, you know, composer, but then the music itself is top quality. It's just absolutely gorgeous. And it's interesting. It's very unique because it's this kind of mixture of a throwback sound But then to have some new features as well, sort of gallant features that would be more of the 18th century contemporary. So for all these reasons, he's really interesting. Tu entri brutus, tu pobre, tu desnudo, tu eladito. Tanto coltor, Señor, tus attributos, reducir ad un poco l'infinito.
And then another artist I knew nothing about, wonderful guitarist, Justin Holland, but he's so much more than that.
Oh yeah, I find his story as well so interesting for many reasons. I have a doctorate in classical guitar performance from a major university, and I had never encountered this musician's music once. Part of that's my own ignorance, but part of it, I think, is just the sad underrepresentation that these composers are experiencing. So here was a guy in the 19th century that was a Black man who was free. He was born in Norfolk, Virginia, moved to Boston, where he learned to play the guitar from a Spaniard. And then that piqued his interest so much that he wanted to move to Mexico so that he could learn to speak Spanish and then read the original books by his favorite musicians, the Fernando Sors, the Dionisio Aguado. And then he returned to the United States, where he was not only publishing a tremendous amount of guitar music, but also teaching and then working with the Underground Railroad and people like Frederick Douglass. So, man, what an incredibly rich life that he lived and that we're only just starting to learn about.
All that is a great story in and of itself, but there's another angle to the story of this album, and that is that this album has now been officially nominated for a Grammy in the Classical Compendium category. What's it feel like to have gotten that Grammy nomination?
Oh, thank you. Yeah, we are absolutely thrilled with the nomination and surprised. I mean, we knew that it was great music, great performances, and these incredible composers that really deserve to be heard. But we still thought that the odds were against us and that would be impossible. Well, it turned out it worked out, and we're really, really happy about that. The voting is happening right now, and we'll see the ultimate result at the Grammys on, I think it's January 31st. I, of course, am happy for myself and my friends, but ultimately, if more people can enjoy this music and perform this music, then we have achieved something positive.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Daniel, Carrie Klein, Mathi Bolaños, and Sarith Hawk. Technical support is from Don Weaver. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, ensuring the voices of Californians are heard in Californians' decisions about healthcare. On the web at chcf.org/voices.